Our afternoon newspaper featured across its front page a banner story which included as artwork the large silhouette of a handgun and a headline which read, "Guns, colon, they're an epidemic here." And on an inside page, there were nearly 140 short paragraphs, each preceded by the outline of a handgun, which detailed the nearly 140 shooting incidents which had taken place in Cleveland during the month of September. Now, the rather florid journalese which accompanied the article began by saying that the guns of Cleveland are nearly never silent. And it ended with a purported letter from a child to Santa Claus, in which the child asked the good fairy for roller skates and a teddy bear and a Colt 45. Now, this article was by way of being the worst kind of sensationalist journalism. It caters to our fears of and fascination with guns and violence. Had the press really wanted to make a contribution to gun control or to the absence and control of violence, it would long since have come out editorially for a position stronger than a limited registration rule and the outlawing of the so-called Saturday night special. But guns kill, and killings sell newspapers. Now, I'm afraid that the newspapers know how to pander to the mixture of fear, fascination, of concern, and of psychological attraction, which represents the ill-considered but very real response of most Americans to the problem of violence and to the explosion of guns among us. I know of no other issue of public concern at the moment of such seriousness, about which Americans are less consistent and less willing to do serious, reasonable, rational thinking. We'll put another lock or bolt on our doors, and then we will sit down in the comfortable chair and turn on the television set to watch an evening of violence. And the television corporations produce the programs of violence because that's what we watch. You know, study after study has made it crystal clear that a gun in the house does not make the house safe. That far more husbands and wives and children are killed accidentally by guns owned in the home than burglars. And many of the studies indicate that a gun in the house, or the possibility of a gun in the house, is not even a deterrent to the thief. For he comes in with a gun out, if he has a gun, and the householder's gun is locked away in a drawer, unloaded, lest the children get to it. He's not afraid of the fumbling noise that you have to make at night to find a firearm. And yet every year, I am told that nearly 5 million more guns are sold to Americans. And guns do not become obsolete. They simply pile up and grow in numbers. Statistics of violence are sickening, frightening. A Harris poll recently released just this past Friday indicates that there are now more gun owners in the United States than there are drinkers or smokers. So 50% of all white homes and 30% of all black homes have a gun. What do we propose to do with this massive arsenal? Can anyone show that the arming of America has led to the disarming of the criminals, to the limitation of crimes of violence? Oh, no. The statistics of violence continue to rise. We need to do some hard, clear thinking about gun control, about the control of violence. And we're not doing it. The best of us are not doing it. I received a call some weeks back from a good lady who introduced herself as chairman of a junior league committee in town, concerned with guns and violence. This group was interested in approaching storekeepers, asking them not to stock guns with toys, cap pistols, and the like. Wouldn't I lend my support to that program? Now, our children never had guns, and I'm not unsympathetic to what she was saying, but I find it difficult to believe that a problem of this magnitude is approached by taking away a water pistol from a six-year-old. She's obviously not in training to be a professional killer. And whatever psychological evidence we have suggests that the six-year-old or the eight-year-old or the 10-year-old playing with a gun in the backyard is simply learning to express himself, to use power. He's not yet on the way to being a violent American. I suggested to my caller that she might like to join with me in a letter which a number of us were addressing to our Congress people in the hopes that they would sponsor a bill which would create federal legislation outlawing all possession, all sales of all guns by anyone in the United States. Oh, my no, she said. My husband has a wonderful gun collection. He loves to hunt, and besides, we feel so safe. Now, Americans are going about the problem of guns and of the control of violence by attacking the least consequential of issues. It's become a great cause in America to eliminate violence from television. Now, violence doesn't necessarily make for good drama. And violence on television may stimulate a few to some crime or other. It may also act as a catharsis, releasing in the living room the violence which might otherwise explode on the street. Certainly, if we're concerned about the 16,000 Americans who are killed each year by guns, a direct approach is far better than this kind of indirect approach. Yet it's this kind of issue which can mobilize Americans, and I would suggest it's this kind of issue which mobilizes our concern because we're not clear that we're really prepared to go all the way. We're really not prepared to take the step which would disarm all Americans. In a meeting some weeks back of a group of clergymen with whom I meet rather regularly, we discussed the whole issue of gun control, and they were pushing very hard at the time for the passage by the city council of the very limited registration and Saturday evening special bill, which was in fact finally passed. And I said to them, I thought this was what we call in our Jewish tradition a bracha levatalah, a useless good deed. And they looked at me aghast. But it's a step forward. I said, no, it isn't. It only makes people feel that something has been accomplished. If you can't buy a gun in Cleveland, you go to some suburb of Cleveland. And what controls do you have over the registration? Time after time, reporters have gone in communities where they are stringing registration procedures and taking the name of a known criminal, bought any gun that they wanted at a local store. But we have come to feel that we can't approach this problem directly. We can't use all of the energies of the country. And as a result, little, if anything, is happening. And I think of violence and of guns. My mind runs to a prophecy from Jeremiah. I transpose Cleveland for Jerusalem in the prophecy. One could transpose any American city. Jeremiah said then in the 7th century before the Common Era, listen carefully to this lesson, O Jerusalem. Outrage and violence echo in your streets. Be careful, lest you become a desolate place. Let people cease to live in you. Violence not only threatens individuals, guns not only kill people, but the spread of violence in America threatens the very fabric of our society because it destroys community. We're no longer a city. We're a city dotted with places where many of us fear to go. When I came back to Cleveland 20 years ago, I carried a single key, the key to my car, and I didn't even lock the door. The other day, as I began to write this sermon, I went into my pocket and I pulled out my keys, and I now carry 17 keys. When I used to make a call in Cleveland 20 years ago, I'd enter the apartment door, I'd look up the name that I wanted to visit, the apartment number, I'd open the door, I'd go in and take the elevator up to the floor, knock on the door, and I'd be admitted. Now when I go to make a call, I come into a glass cage, and I look on the wall, and there is a list of the apartment owners in some order, and a code number next to their name. And there's a telephone on the wall and a closed-circuit television in the ceiling. And I have to dial the code number into the phone, and while I am identifying myself by voice, I'm being scanned by this closed-circuit television. And if I pass muster, then the door is open because I'm told the number of the apartment, and I walk into an empty lobby. Great hospitable welcome, or if there's a piece of furniture in there, every piece of furniture is manacled to the floor. And I go to the elevator, and I go to your floor, and I knock on the door, and then the peephole is opened. And if I pass that final muster, I'm allowed to come in and make the call. Now, we're beginning to live in these United States as the Tegel people lived. Behind walls and moats. There's a peephole in our door, and there's several locks on our door, and there's electronic protection equipment in our home, and we're afraid to go out at night. Once darkness descended in the medieval world, people stayed within their homes and within their walls. We thought we were modern. But how many of you have ceased to go to the symphony or the theater at night? Certain places of the city. I'm afraid that we are losing the sense of community. And more than that, we are burdening the economy with a burden which it may not be able to bear. I saw some statistics the other day that we're now spending more for private security than we do for police. And I read the other day that the average goods which are sold in the store cost 10% more than they need to because we're spending that 10% for security at all levels of the society. Now, do we want a community which is a series of houses and apartments which are fortresses against the rest of the community? That's only going to increase crime. Because always between the walls, there's a place for the criminal. Always between the walls is the darkness with violence occurring. I'm shocked, I'm sure you are, and saddened by the statistics of violence. It's a serious, major national problem, an issue of public policy. And I do not mock or scorn the acts of prudence. We get to tell our children and our wives not to go into certain parts of the city at certain times of the day or night. But at the same time, I'm saddened and worried by the spreading mist of fear. If you were so, the fear blinds us to reason. And so many of the actions that we are taking are unreasonable, irrational responses to a real problem. If guns don't protect the home, why do we buy the guns? 5 million of them every year. The only violence to a person, which is, to my knowledge has taken place on temple property in the last decade, took place in our parking lot several years ago after a holiday service in the evening, when a man went into his glove compartment to find his driving gloves and accidentally triggered the mace that he had there, and it spilled out into his face. The very protections which we adopt threaten us very often far more than they threaten the other, the enemy, those that we fear. And there's a certain climate of fear spreading further and further among us. And there's that climate of fear which brings a city to a point where things don't take place anymore. When we go out socially, almost the first item of conversation is, did you hear that so-and-so's house was robbed? Or I heard that in such and such apartment building, somebody was attacked or some purse was snatched. We feed on this kind of gossip. We live with it. We exaggerate the problem through it. And there are those who are now, for their own benefit, exaggerating the problem, and they may be making us even more fearful yet. A neighbor, a doctor who lives just across the street from us, was working in his front yard 10 days ago. A man, he came down the street and held him up at gunpoint and took him and his children to his house and tied him up and robbed him. Within 24 hours after this event, a silky voice had called us on the telephone. Isn't it terrible what happened to your neighbor? And don't you need our protection? How can you live on Weybridge Road without it? Just as there were blockbusters when race became the issue, so there are now merchants of fear. The violence, the gun, has become an issue. Let's be reasonable. Violence and human life have always, since Cain and Abel, gone hand in hand. Let's be reasonable about it. As long as there have been cities, there's been violence and crime and danger. Men have always had to adjust to it, and so will we. Let's be careful. Let's be prudent. But let's be sure that our response to violence is an intelligent one, an effective one. It may be that our criminal judicial system needs an overhaul. Maybe that criminal justice is too tardy, or that sentences are too erratic. It may be. But were we to create the most perfect system of criminal justice, what has this to do with violence or with crime? It's been shown that fear of punishment is not an effective deterrent. The criminal justice system does not begin to operate until after the crime has taken place. More policemen, more electronic equipment, more private patrols, these will not solve the problem of crime. Let's be sure that the response we make is not hysterical, but calm and intelligent. Now, what can this response consist of? In the first instance, it must consist of federal legislation prohibiting the manufacture or the purchase or the ownership of any firearm, all firearms. We don't need guns any longer. We don't need guns to hunt. We have butcher shops for our meat. We don't need guns to protect our homes. They don't protect our homes. The ownership of a gun is not a constitutional right. No court has ever so ordered. The Constitution says simply that the militia in a state have the right to have arms. And certainly those who protect the public weal have a responsibility to bear arms in our protection. But what have arms to do, guns to do with our safety? Why do we need them? And what advantage can they be to us? Every president since President Eisenhower has been shot at. Men of the right, Governor Wallace, men of moral courage, Martin Luther King, the two Kennedys, they've been assassinated. More Americans have been killed by guns fired by other Americans than Americans have been killed by guns fired by enemy soldiers. We're killing people in Cleveland at the rate of a man a day. We're killing people in these United States with guns at the rate of 16,000 a year. Why do we need guns? What good do guns do us? But here again, this ambivalence begins to enter. We fear guns. Every poll suggests that Americans in the abstract would vote for some gun control legislation to a very large degree. Over 70% favor it. But at the same time, we don't favor it enough to be single-minded about it, to force our congresspeople to vote for it. And I suspect that this is in part because America came of age, or our myths were created, at the period where the gun was the weapon that the hero used, and we turned every teenage delinquent on the in the frontier into a great gun-toting hero. And we associated the ownership of a gun with virility and masculinity. And somehow we took over the English upper class attitude that the hunt was a form of sport, and the man who knew how to use the gun was a gentleman. All of these ideas somehow interrelate and make it difficult for us to accept legislation which would prohibit the ownership of guns. It's not hard to see how we could do without guns. There could be professional hunters to limit the herds of wild animals that might get out of size. Guns could be stored when they're needed for civil defense or the like. But certainly we need federal gun control legislation. And certainly there's very little likelihood that federal gun control legislation will pass. For all of the carnage, for all of the assassinations, so twice within the month the current president, President Ford, has had guns pointed at him. Americans have passed only one bit of federal gun control legislation since the end of the Second World War. And as this piece of legislation was finally worked out in 1968, it was far more successful in protecting the profits of the domestic gun industry than in being an effective means of gun control. What did that bill achieve? It prohibited the importation of guns from overseas. Well and good. But what does that achieve? It gave a monopoly to Remington and to Winchester and to the other gun-making companies who would otherwise have had to compete with cheap arms brought in from abroad. It did not diminish the sale of guns in the United States by a single gun. And the act provided that there should be no sale of guns by mail across state boundaries. And what did that achieve? It eliminated the mail order gun, but it simply protected the profits of the big companies, the department stores, the sports stores, and the like, who sell guns as part of their ordinary traffic. It protected them because their overhead was greater than that of the mail order company. The third major provision of this bill was a gun registration provision, which said that at the time of purchase, the purchaser had to give his name and his address. But there was no provision in the bill that anyone had to check up on the name and on the address. You could give any name and any address. And that's it. That's the only federal gun control legislation we have had since the end of the Second World War. How many have to die? How many presidents have to be assassinated? How long? Now, if we cannot approach directly as yet the problem of gun control, because most of us are not yet sure that guns really don't protect us, what can we do about the control of violence? I heard a speech some time ago in which the speaker, using a very awkward metaphor, referred to guns as a cancer on the body politic. He used the phrase unimaginatively. But I began to think about it. And in many ways, the control of violence and cancer are similar phenomena. For as we've studied cancer in the last 20 or 25 years, we've discovered that it's not a single thing. It's a body of diseases. It's a body of diseases which attack in different ways different parts of the body. And each of the separate ways in which cancer or the cancers attack the body has to be studied and has to be dealt with. And violence is a similar phenomenon. It's not a single thing. There's no single answer to the problem of violence. It's a complex social, psychological phenomenon. And we've got to understand much more about it. And we understand very little about it. They tell me that for every $100 spent on cancer research in the United States, there's less than 5 cents spent on research into violence. We really do not know the dimensions of the problem. And that's one of the reasons we're not yet understanding of ways of attacking the problem. Oh, we have simple solutions. One simple solution is to increase the police power. But that only increases police power. It doesn't solve the problem of violence. And men of goodwill for the last 30 years or so have had a simple solution. Violence occurs because there's injustice in the society. Let's eliminate the injustice and we'll eliminate violence. Now, the injustice of the society ought to be eliminated. But there's absolutely no indication anywhere that guns are held in robberies because of poverty. And the men of goodwill from the middle class and the upper class should have known it. What's a robber baron? He's a man who has everything, who's a thief. There's no correlation between enough and the lack of violence, unwillingness to use a gun. We should eliminate poverty. There should be opportunity for all. But even so, violence, if we were to achieve it, violence would exist in the social order. The greatest increase in violence in recent American history occurred during the decade of greatest abundance, the 1960s. What do we know about violence? Not very much. We do know that violence is somehow correlated to age. That something over one half of the crimes of violence which occur in the United States are committed by adolescents. By young men and young women under the age of 20. That's when the emotions are the swiftest and the most thrusting. That's when the controls are the least developed. But we also know that it's not the whole body of adolescents who are violent. It's a very specific number of adolescents. We can identify them to a degree psychologically. One truth about violence is that it is a reflection of certain types of personality. Study after study has shown that a youngster who commits a crime of violence will commit another and another, suggesting that the explosion is always near the surface. And the Erickson Institute and others where violent personalities have been studied describe some of the characteristics of the violent person, the violent adolescent. He or she is a young person who grew up in an environment in which there was no consistent value system, no consistent system of rewards and punishments, and therefore little chance for that child to develop a superego, a conscience. They grew up in an environment, in a home or on the street, where there was little, if any, patience or support from any adult. And therefore, the adult world, the so-called real world, is always a threat. Therefore, they always walk around psychologically with their fists up, ready to defend themselves. Because the adolescent world punishes. It never encourages. By and large, these are young people who were not successful in school. They have had no rewards from the adult world. Therefore, they are prepared to be hurt, and they are prepared because they know no other way of defending themselves to strike back. A surprising percentage of the crimes of violence are committed by the adolescent, and within that group, a surprising percentage are committed by a very small percent who have certain kinds of definable personality characteristics. Now, certainly we could do something about identifying this group. Certainly we could try to provide rehabilitation, a new environment for them during their formative years. Certainly we could begin to separate out this group from those who are simply thrill-seeking, who become delinquent for other reasons, and treat those who are thrill-seekers, those who are commit minor crimes but unviolent crimes in one way without incarceration in homes which are simply schools and crime, and treating these others, these more violent personality types, in quite other ways, psychiatrically and so on. I'm not suggesting to you this morning that I understand the epidemiology of violence. I don't think anybody does as yet. I'm simply suggesting to you that the ways in which we're going to go about solving the problem, mitigating the problem, dealing with it, is through research and through reason and by controlling our fears. There are many things that can be done. All of us recognize that there are places in the city where we feel safe, and there are places in the city where we do not feel safe. Why do we feel safe in one community and not in another? Because it's better design, better lit, there are less walls. It has more of a sense of community. People know each other. One of the reasons that crime takes place to the degree it does is that in the large community there's aloneness, anonymity. You're not known. You can flit in the darkness. You don't fear recognition. Where there is community, there is a web of restrictions. There is a web of fears which come into being, which tend to dampen and limit the amount of violence. Our communities need some kind of redesigning and better lighting. We need a more efficient police force to protect us. We need certain kinds of surveillance. We need to be able to begin to identify the violent personality, and to separate that personality for purposes of rehabilitation, if we can, or if we cannot, to separate them from society so they do not endanger the social order. We need to take away the guns. Oh, there'll be knives around, and there'll be fists around, but a knife is a far less lethal weapon than a gun, and fists bruise more than they kill. And yes, there will be explosions. And yes, there will be anger. And yes, there will be the temptation to violence, because most murders occur within a family, among friends, where an argument has grated and reached the point where the violence explodes. There will be violence. We don't know yet how to take the natural animal energy of man and sublimate it purely in constructive ways. The violence will be less lethal, and that will be a plus. And we can begin, I think, if we can take a few short steps towards the reduction of violence and of fear in our society, to begin to look at this problem calmly, and intelligent. As long as men and women will live in society and refuse to deaden themselves through chemicals, so long will there be violence, which is to say, violence will surround us as long as we live. But there are degrees of violence, and there are programs which can protect us, and programs of social benefit. And what we need is research, calmness, and understanding. And what we do not need is the demagogue who cries out, more police, more control, more guns. That's not the way. Nor would we is the way to limit the due process which now takes place within our legal system, which protects the innocent. Some who are guilty may escape. So we can't keep feeding people into our prisons. Did you see yesterday that in the state of Georgia, because the prisons were overcrowded, 1,000 criminals are to be released this week? What are we to do? We've got to begin to separate criminal from criminal, the pathological from those who are not a threat to persons. We've got to begin to be innovative and find reconstructive processes outside of the prison system. There are many things which need to be learned and many things which need to be done. And my only plea to you this morning is not to develop the psychology that was evidenced in that press article on Monday last, which is to react with fear and anxiety and frustration to the existence of violence, to separate yourself out from the climate of fear which is developing among us, to be adult, to accept our world for what it is, to be willing to be energetic when there are viable programs which can be effective, and to tell those who try to pander to our fears or to sell papers through them or to sell us protection that we do not need, we have only contempt for what they are doing. That we will not be stampeded. That we will do what needs to be done. That we will take care of our families as best we can. But that we recognize that to live is to take a chance. If we want to live in cities, the chance, the odds increase. There was the old phrase that our president some years ago made so popular. We have nothing to fear, the fear itself. We have something to fear. But the greatest fear is fear itself. Amen.